What is happening? It's Yogi Roth, and welcome back to the Life Without Limits podcast. I'm telling you, this thing just keeps feeding me in such unique ways. I've had so many fun guests, obviously kicking it off with my mom, and then we had Wordsmith, a guest that I had targeted for months. He didn't flinch. Brought on Kevin Carroll, who I know inspired you about the power of play. Brett Hughes and his story of really bucking every trend when he's living in Columbus, Ohio, and going to Virginia to become an All-American, and now taking the lessons he learned on the lacrosse field to the real world. But today is Steve Fizziok. And Fizz, as we will call him throughout this show, is one of my greatest mentors. First guy I've ever broadcasted college football with. Taught me everything from what the cough button was to just how to operate in that environment. And I couldn't be more fortunate to have him in my life. But I also can't be more fortunate to have all you in this life and listening in, and I appreciate it. And I want to make sure as we get going, I say thank you, and your reviews, your notes are awesome. And let's get it going again as we bring in the man, Steve Fizziok. Fizz, you there, man?
Yes, I am, Yogi. And your words were too kind, because it's interesting how you get teachers and when you're a student in this world. And when I was put together and working with you and Samantha Steele, I mean, it was a wonderful opportunity, and I thought it was fun because each of us called the other RD. I was road dad to Samantha Steele and to Yogi Roth, and you were my RS, road son, and Samantha was my road daughter. But we got along so well and had so much fun broadcasting college football. But you're a light in the world, and all of the work that you've done, you've been truly an inspiration for others, including myself.
Thanks, man. That means a lot. And for those of you that don't know, Sam Steele is now Sam Ponder, crushing it on College Game on ESPN. She's going to be a guest on this podcast as well, Steve. We got her coming on in the next couple weeks. But I'm jacked to bring you on. I mean, literally, as you heard in the open, you taught me everything as I got going. But I want to ask questions about you that I'm really curious about. I think I know you really well, but as I was preparing for this, I was like, man, there's certain things I don't know. And the premise of this podcast is talking to people who've gone for it in their life, and clearly you have. So I want to start off, because now everybody knows you're calling games for the Royals, World Series, reigning champs. You're trying to go for it again this year. But what was it like for you as a kid? You know, I knew you grew up in that same community. And what was your upbringing like? Were you a shy child? Were you always an outgoing, outspoken individual? Now, obviously, having a career, you know, on air, on TV, and on radio.
Well, I was raised by two wonderful parents, Ray and Betty Fizziok, and my mom is one of the really true inspirations in my life. And I was raised in Merriam, Kansas, one of five children. I'm in the middle. And my mom gave me basically this attic room. The two girls had their own room, and two other boys had the room. And I asked my mom later, why did you give me the room? I was the one who wasn't very good in school. I didn't deserve a room by myself. And she said, you always liked being by yourself, and you weren't scared of the dark. So when we were little, you got this little attic room, and it was a ridiculous little room. But I really appreciated that time alone, because I love to read, and I still do. I constantly read, and it doesn't matter if it's an action adventure or a spiritual book. I'm testing myself as a writer as well. But I was raised by a woman who was a school teacher, and Betty Fizziok always put a book in my hand and said, read this. It's a very interesting story, and whether it was about American history, about the American Revolution, or Abraham Lincoln and his work. And I was motivated by those things, and many, many times opening up a book and reading an adventure, I wanted to create that adventure myself, whether it was joining Boy Scouts and going out on a scouting adventure, or being part of a whitewater rafting adventure, or going to a national park and camping out and doing those kinds of things. But a lot of times, you know, when you talked about, was I a shy kid? I wouldn't say I was a shy kid, but I really enjoyed being alone. I enjoyed others' company as well. And quite frankly, I'm in other people's company all the time when I'm at Royal Stadium, Kauffman Stadium, where yesterday we had a crowd of 35,000, and you're broadcasting to people. But I still enjoy time alone, time with my faith, time with my wife, Stacy. And my mom and dad both raised us with that environment of challenging yourself, of not giving in to failure, of taking a look at it like it was mistakes. And my wife has a great line about this, the earth. She calls it earth school. And I think my mom looked at our lives the same way and taught us the same way. And so when you're given those opportunities, when you face challenges like I did when I went to college and tried to quit, and your mom fights you on that, you eventually cave in and do the right thing. And I was truly inspired by both my mom and my dad.
What do you think it is about being alone? You know, it seems like nowadays kids, you know, don't want to be alone, or, you know, per se, whether that means they're with a friend or with their a device. So for you, do you think that sparked a lot of your curiosity when you were on your own and pondering whether it was different thoughts or different experiences?
You know, I'm not sure who the philosopher was, but it was a Greek philosopher said, at the core of man's problems is his inability to be alone in a room with his own thoughts. And quite frankly, I do that every single morning. I get up, I have my prayer or meditation time, and I need that time to kind of right my compass. I always talk about getting my compass needle back to north. And I do the same thing when I lay my head down in the bed, trying to get my compass needle back to north. So the problems during the day that may pull that needle off to the side, whether it's somebody done me wrong or you get fired or your boss yells at you, if your needle is pointed in the right direction, then those problems or challenges aren't going to affect you as much as in a negative way. But I think being by yourself, and I do that in the morning, every single morning, I have my quiet time, my meditation time, and then I'll go work out by myself, and then I'll come back, and whether I get together with a coworker, in this case, a fellow broadcaster like Rex Hudler or Ryan Lefevre, and we'll break bread and have lunch and talk about the game, and then I usually come back to my hotel room and study for the game and then go to the ballpark, and that's when I engage with other people and talk to the players and the coaches and prepare for my daily event. In this case, it's the Kansas City Royals against whoever they're playing.
You know, you've, I don't know, what I'm assuming you know it, but your nickname in the media industry is you're the nicest guy in all of sports. And I wonder how your parents or which parent instilled A, the positivity, but also that you are a shining light, man. I always often refer on this podcast, we're trying to bring people on that have a flame that is just charging. And I think we're attracted to flames that are stoked. And yours seems like it always is. And wondering how that was taught to you, and then in turn, how you pass that on now to your kids and the people that you're around.
Well, I think if I don't watch the news as often as most people, I will, you know, check in on CNN on my computer, but I really don't watch that much because I think that chaos in the world, and they're giving us this bad information, the negative that's going on in the world. So what I try and do is get my mind right. And my wife, Stacy, is a classic example. I use her as an example because sometimes I'm not sure why I do things. I do them to get my mind right. But Stacy, every single morning she gets up and she says, thank you. Thank you to God for her health, for the joy that she is going to plan for her life. And her next question is, I am here to be truly helpful. What can I do to serve? And this is a woman who, has had many setbacks in her life. She had 7 miscarriages, lost 8 babies. We adopted 2 children. And we have taken a look at those situations as that is part of our earth school and learning. But if you can get your mind right in the morning, and that's why I like that alone time, to get my mind right, to get with my spirit, and I'm big on the biology of belief, that if you are determined to see good in others, you'll find it. If also you're determined to see bad in others, you'll find that too. So I think it's kind of like a biology of belief where I am, I have very good focus. And one of my mantras is, God is but love, therefore so am I. And so I have to share that light, that optimism, that positivity with others around me regardless of what takes place. If someone cuts me off on the road, or like I said, if a boss gets upset with me, sometimes that's a challenge that that individual might be going through in his life. But I can't let that affect my attitude. And that's why I always try and choose happiness, kindness, and usually like attracts like.
Were you taught that as a kid, or did that come about with you and Stacy, this ideology?
I think it's all of the above. I think my parents were both positive thinkers and very determined to look at the good. They always were very open-minded, too. They wanted me to get involved with the with the community. And when I say an open mind, I'm saying don't be so fundamental in your thought. And we were raised Christian, but be open-minded to people, whether they're Buddhists or Hindus or of the Jewish faith or of the Muslim faith. Be open-minded. You still have your faith, but take what is available from those faiths. And usually, if you take a look at all faiths, there's included in all faiths is kindness, love, understanding, charity, forgiveness. And it's all of the other things that we stare at, our differences that sometimes anger us or separate us. But my parents always said, be inclusive, be open-minded. Challenge yourself to love. And then, quite frankly, I've been on a spiritual path my entire life. I've always been a seeker. I've always been wanting to know why I'm here. What is my purpose? So when you're a seeker and you're open-minded, you're always challenging yourself. So I think it's all of the above. Yes, I did have two very good parents, and I had wonderful brothers and sisters, but I also challenged myself to find the good, find the divine in everything and everyone. And so so I guess I do practice what I preach.
What was it like when you first started to practice in college? You know, I know you didn't have immediate success academically your first semester. What was that journey like for you? And then how did you get into broadcasting?
Well, it was very humbling because I was not a good student. I was the worst of the five kids that my mom and dad had, and I went to Kansas State University, and I failed miserably. I had a 1.75 GPA my first semester. I wanted to quit. I actually took classes for my second semester, stayed 1 week, and then went to the university, dropped my classes, got my money back, went home, and on the drive back to Kansas City, I thought of all of the arguments that my mom would work with me and challenge me. And I had an answer for every single one with the exception of one. I didn't know what I would do when she started to cry. And so, like any son, I put my tail between my legs. I went back to Kansas State. I apologized. I re-enrolled, and obviously they had students who had gone through this situation before. I was able to get my GPA up enough to be eligible, but then in that summer, my dad went bankrupt, so I lost money because it was in his name as well, and I had to stay out of school for a while and make money. And then when I went back, something took place while I was away, and I was working as a busboy in a restaurant in Kansas City, and I said, you love sports, but you're really not that good at it, but you love talking about it. Why don't you take a class? Well, all I can tell you is I took a class, and my professor was Bob Fidler, and it was a 10-watt radio station, and he challenged us to sell time in downtown Manhattan, Kansas. I sold the most. He gave me the opportunity to do high school football. And, Yogi, all I can tell you is when I did that football game, I walked out of the press box, and my hands were shaking. And they weren't shaking because it was a great game. They were shaking because I discovered what it was that I would do for the rest of my life. I love play-by-play, and I've done it for 40 years, and I still love doing it. I really enjoy preparing for the Kansas City Royals, in this case tonight against the Houston Astros, and I enjoy the homework, the preparation. But had I quit and not had a mother who said, go back to school, challenge yourself, I don't care how many classes you take, along the way you'll discover what it is that you're going to do for the rest of your life. And that's exactly what happened. And the two best questions my mom told me when I was a kid. She said the two most important decisions you're going to make in your life are what you're going to be when you grow up and who you're going to spend the rest of your life with. And I have hit a home run with both in choosing sportscasting and play-by-play, and also Stacy, who's been my greatest friend and greatest teacher in this life.
No, I get the chills when you say that, because my dad, who you've connected with over the years, says the exact same thing. What are you going to do, and who are you going to spend your time with? The two most important decisions. So I'd love to ask you, when your dad goes bankrupt, what's that feel like for someone that I'm assuming you're about 20, 21 years old?
You know, I was so, I think at that age, you're so involved in yourself. I do regret the fact that I don't think I was as understanding to what my mom was going through. You know, I mean, yeah, we lost our money, but quite frankly, it wasn't the first time. He had gone bankrupt when we were in New Jersey and I was 6 years old, and this was another time my dad did have some financial difficulties. And but we were able to make it through. And one of the great things is that sometimes with problems come seeds of opportunity. And I'll give you an example. I go back to work, and I worked two jobs. One was as a busboy, and I gave all my money to my mother. And when I went back to Kansas State, I said, let's see how we can make this money work. And I remember at the end of the first month, I had like 8 days left, and I only had like $7. And so I called her up, and I said, hey, Mom, could you forward me next month's rent and money? I know we talked about how we would make this work. And she asked me, well, did you go to any bars in Manhattan? And I said, a few, but not as many as my friends. And then she said, well, did you go to any fast food joint? And I said, a few, but not as many as my friends. And she said, well, it looks like you'll have to cut those out the next week. And then she hung up on me. And Yogi, what it made me do, I had to discipline myself. I had to take that $7, and I had to make it work. So I went to the local grocery store. I probably bought about 30 boxes of Kraft macaroni and cheese. And then on Monday, I'd have Kraft macaroni and cheese and peas. On Tuesday, I'd have macaroni and cheese and corn. On Wednesday, I'd have macaroni and cheese and rice, you know, whatever it was. But you can make it work. But what it did was it disciplined me on how to structure my finances, that you can't spend what you don't have. And to this day, I have never been in debt. I've always paid off my credit cards every single month. And I think it's because of what we didn't have rather than what I did have. And quite frankly, I'm a little disappointed in myself as a father that I didn't challenge my own kids, because we did have enough. I did pay for college for my daughter and my son. And it's interesting how we grow in certain ways, but it, to this day, it's a discipline I've always had. You can't spend what you don't have. And it was from my mom's discipline and that hanging up that phone. And I'm to this day, I thank her for that.
What's your mom like? I mean, paint a picture for everybody, because I've heard about this woman for, gosh, now 10 years. And I think everybody should get an idea of what she's all about.
Well, tomorrow she will be 90 years old.
Wow.
And she has been the greatest light in my life as far as a person who pushed me, who didn't let me fail, who challenged me to go back to school. And I've thanked her like countless times. Like, I could have gone to the Pacific Northwest, because that's what I was going to go do. Go to the Pacific Northwest, get a job, go work in a lumber mill, and instead of go to school. And she said, no, go back to Kansas State. You'll discover what it is your passion. So I thank her all the time that she was able to do that. And she was so positive and so optimistic. And yet she has Alzheimer's now. And that is one of the most difficult things I've ever gone through, because all of a sudden my mother isn't the woman she used to be. And the fact that some fears have cropped up that never existed in her or our conversation. And to me, it's so sad to see this woman who's so independent and so strong be so dependent and so fearful in her final years. And it's difficult to watch. I mean, I was with her just yesterday, and we have great times together, a wonderful, but it hurts me. And I'm sure, Yogi, if you were with her, you wouldn't even notice it, but it hurts me because I know what this woman was and what Alzheimer's and the dementia has done to her. So it's it's rather tragic for me and hurtful. But sometimes I go, is that my ego who is creating that design rather than just be separate myself as a son and just take a look at her as a holy child of God, and that she needs help rather than the independent, dynamic, optimistic woman that she was and still is and still is there. But the Alzheimer's, the dementia has brought up fears that have really been rather tragic.
You know, we have a wide variety of ages that listen to this podcast, Steve, and a lot of people are going through this as well, whether it's losing parents,
yeah.
parents getting older, parents going through what your mom is going through. You kind of just explained how you process it, but when it does get hard, right? I mean, you're such a positive guy, but how do you deal with it when you are down and out, or it does break your heart after a visitation with her?
You know, I remember reading something about Shakespeare, and he wrote a little bit about melancholy. And I think we all have to realize that that's part of our life too, that we can't always have this joy in our heart every single moment of every day, that there's going to be melancholy. There's going to be that sadness, and you just go ahead and welcome it. And another great thing that my mom taught me was, and it comes with a little story. I had been dating a girl at Kansas State for 3 years, and the day before I left for my first job in Hastings, Nebraska, she told me that she liked somebody else, and it was a dear friend of mine. Well, that broke my heart, and for the first 10 days while I was in Hastings, I did my job. You know, I was working like 13, 14 hours a day, but when I'd go home at night, that's when it would bother me the most, and I remember calling my mom, and for 10 days, she listened to me complain about losing this girl and blah, blah, blah. And finally, at the end of it, she said, Steve, on the 10th day, she goes, Steve, I've listened to you for 10 days complain about your girlfriend breaking up with you. All I want you to know is unless you had your heart broken, you will not understand love. And unless you have been alone, you'll not realize that it is just a emotion. It's loneliness. And you will not truly understand yourself and grow as a human being unless you've been alone, gone through this loneliness, and come out on the other side. And I thought, at the time, it was a punch in the gut. But I look back on that, and every single time I'd have that melancholy or that disappointment that my girlfriend had broken up with me, I said, hey, you know what? Unless I have my heart breaking, I won't understand love. And unless I don't go through loneliness, I won't just understand it's an emotion that's going to help me grow. And that's why, to this day, I don't mind being alone. And I also realize that those moments of disappointment with a broken heart, all of those things led me to Stacy, who has been, you know, the soulmate that I've met in my life. And she has been truly an inspiration. And I always go, everything led me to Stacy, and we've been married 31 years in September.
So let's talk about that meeting. And because you are from Hastings, Nebraska to Cincinnati, and how does this love story even begin?
Well, she's in the same industry, or she was at the time, and I had seen her on the air, and I had an immediate crush. I mean, immediate. I saw her on the air and go, oh my gosh, who is that girl? She is absolutely gorgeous. And but I found out she was dating somebody, and so I saw her like, I think two or three times. I remember all of those moments. She doesn't remember. She remembers maybe one, but she was dating somebody else at the time. But each time I was like kind of dumbfounded in that, rather, you know, like one time she came into the office and I'm standing there and she said hello and I kind of like burped and just kind of stared, but I didn't introduce myself and say, hey, it's nice to meet you. Well, anyway, a dear friend of mine, Todd Donahoe, worked with her and it was her birthday. And she knew that the young man that she was dating was going to propose, but she wasn't in love, and she didn't want to hurt him. So he said, he noticed her sadness, and he said, Stacy, you shouldn't be alone today. It's your birthday. I'm going to get a group together, and we're going to go down to Barleycorn's in Cincinnati. And she said, okay. Well, then he calls me up because he's a dear friend, and had he told me that Stacy was going to be there, I would have immediately gone. But I'm not a night owl. But Todd Donahoe is one of those great people. I replaced him in Cincinnati, and we maintained a friendship, even though he was fired and I was hired. So we have this great connection, and he calls me up and he said, "Hey, Fizz, a few of us are getting together at Barleycorn's. You want to come down?" And I said, "Sure." Had it been anybody else, I wouldn't have gone, but Todd invited me, so I'd go down there. Well, there is Stacy, and I grabbed a chair and pulled it up next to her, and Todd tells a story later in years. He goes, "It was like every single light in Barleycorn's was off, except there was a spotlight on Steve and Stacy. They were engaged in this conversation." Well, we knew immediately that it was meant to be, and I asked her out that night, and that was the beginning of our courtship, and 10 months later, we were married.
Wow. That's awesome, and if anybody's not met Stacy, please try to find her at a Royals game, because she's awesome, man. What was it like? You referenced it earlier. You guys have been, you know, through the fire together. You reference multiple miscarriages. You adopted two kids. What's that process like? Because we see it go one way or the other a lot of times. And I think your story is an example that will help some people if they're going through some adversity in their relationship.
That's where your faith comes in. And that's where our belief comes in. And that's why Stacy is such an inspiration. And I'll let you know, she is so positive and so optimistic that every time she had a miscarriage, she gave herself one day to grieve. And she would grieve, and then she'd wake up the next morning, smile on her face. You know, how can I be truly helpful? That's part of the past. And she always believed that there was a reason for this, and it was leading to something else. Well, it led us to our daughter, Ryan, who's now 29 years old and married and has given us three beautiful grandchildren, and she has been such a light in our life. And then the last miscarriage was the most devastating because Stacy carried the longest. She carried 6 months, and the baby died in her arms, lived 2 hours, and that was the only time she grieved more than one day. And it took her 2 weeks to get over that. And I remember calling our adoption lawyer, and I told him, I said, "David, Stacy miscarried," and I said, "She needs a baby. And I don't care if it's a puppy. My wife needs to hold on to a baby." So he went to work. And the amazing story about that, and there are coincidences in both adoptions that are flat amazing. But in this case, he called me on December 28th to say, "A girl has chosen you." What you do is you write up a resume on why you think you'd be good parents, and then he turns it into prospective girls. Well, on December 28th, he called me and said, a young lady has selected you to be the mother and father to her child. Well, December 28th is my birthday, and to this day, that's the greatest birthday present I've ever received. That was the call that Kevin would be our son, and he was born March 1st. And Kevin now is 27 years old. He's a junior at San Francisco State. He's gone through some difficulties with depression and other things, but now he has, I call him my prodigal son, where he once was lost, now he's found. He is this dynamic young person. He is positive and optimistic, and he's making straight A's, and he's making a difference in the world and making others feel better. He has always been a person who looked out for those who were in trouble, and or cared for those who were needy. And both of them, we don't get either child unless we go through those miscarriages. And it was a great lesson for both of us. And we had to go through it. And that's one of the reasons why we call this place Earth School. And I think if you think about your troubles, they become troubles. But if you think about them as seeds of opportunities, well, then you can take them in a completely different direction and really grow from those experiences.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that. And I'm curious, you know, you're broadcasting throughout this, you know, these instances in your guys' life and your relationship, from losing children to gaining two children. How did the profession of connecting to an audience, broadcasting a sport, how did it, if it did, help you go through this and weave your way through potentially your grieving process?
You know, I think sports, and you might, I think you will understand what I'm saying. I think it is the toy department of life. And I think people think we take it a little too seriously at times. But I think it's a great example of humanity. I'll use my team, the Kansas City Royals, as an example. They struggle for three decades. But all of a sudden, they start doing the right things. They hire the right general manager. He is disciplined and his patience and taking time. But it's not a sudden rise to the top. You're going to go through challenges. You're going to go through falls. You're going to go through difficulties. But the last 2 years, to see what has taken place with the Kansas City Royals, it's the greatest sports achievement I've ever been a part of in my life, because they are the very definition of team. What happens when you truly don't care who gets the credit, when you put others first? And I'll use my marriage as an example. If I put Stacy first and Stacy puts me first, how do we fail? Well, I saw the same thing happen with this team, where Mike Moustakas, who had not laid down a sacrifice bunt the entire season, in the postseason of 2014, drops a sacrifice bunt to get Terrence Gore in the scoring position. The next batter gets a base hit. Mike Moustakas gave himself up for his teammate. And I know a lot of people will go, well, that's just a silly sport. But you know what? It's an example of what can take place. And I watched a team go through the hardships when I got there in 2012, but I knew they were getting better. They were young. They weren't ready yet. And then in 13, they win 86 games. And then 14, they win 89. And they make it all the way to the World Series. And obviously, in life, there are those moments that are the turning point. For us, it was the Oakland A's coming back from four runs down in the seventh inning, facing John Lester. Impossible odds. Yet they did it, and they won. But every single time, they did it together. And they had each other's back. They love each other. I've never been around a team that enjoys each other and plays with such passion and happiness and joy. And people go, well, that's, you know, all teams do that. No, I've been doing Major League Baseball for 34 years. I've never seen a team like this. And it's really wonderful to watch. Sometimes you go, why would he bunt in that situation? That was stupid. But I look at it and go, he did it for his teammates. Who cares? I mean, whether it's right or wrong doesn't matter. He did it for someone else. And it happened yesterday. Paul Orlando attempted a bunt when he shouldn't have, but he did it to try and get his teammate in scoring position. He didn't advance. Well, anyway, we did win the game, which was a wonderful thing to have happen. But I always take a look at it. Did he do it for his teammates? And the Kansas City Royals are an example of that, and I think that's why they're the world champions.
You know, I want to jump back for a minute to a quote-unquote former teammate of yours that I think people get a chuckle out of. But when you're in Cincinnati, is it true that Jerry Springer was like the co-host on the network you were working on?
Yeah, I was on WLWT, and we were dead last in the ratings when I got there in 1982, and Jerry Springer had been the mayor, and they put this team together with Jerry and Norma Rashid were the co-anchors. I was the sports anchor, and Pat Barry was the weatherman, and we shot to the top. I mean, quite frankly, it was Jerry had a lot to do it because he's a very talented guy, but he's one of the smartest people I've ever met and one of the funniest people I've ever met. But I would like to see him change his show a little bit. He did come into the White Sox booth when I was broadcasting a White Sox Angels game years ago, and he looked at me and I said, I mean, I know him well enough where I can say this, and I go, Jerry, you sold out. And he goes, I know, but I'm making so much money. But even though he has this awful show, in my opinion, he is a light. He does help a lot of people, and his show is not one I'm a fan of, but I really don't watch it that much. But he's a very interesting guy and one of the funniest and one of the smartest people I've ever been around.
It's amazing how many different people cross our paths. So I want to talk about another path. You know, this is obviously a historic year for the Golden State Warriors. You did play-by-play for them in the early 90s. What's it like to watch that organization now you know, whatever it is, 25 years later?
Well, that team, when I broadcast them in the early 90s, was another team that I really admired. Unfortunately, they were in the same division as the Los Angeles Lakers, who were the best team in the NBA, with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Magic Johnson and everybody, James Worthy. But the crew that Don Nelson put together was just a fantastic group to travel with, and they, too, loved each other. They didn't experience the same kind of ultimate success that the Royals have achieved, but they truly enjoyed each other's company. Mitch Richmond, Tim Hardaway, Chris Mullin, Sharunas Marshalonis, Jim Peterson, Terry Teagle. They had this whole group of guys that really enjoyed each other, and I'd see them out to dinner, sharing each other's company and telling jokes. And it was just a great group to travel with. But to see them go through the hard times after they almost got to the mountaintop in the early 90s, unfortunately, the Lakers were always in their way. But then to see this success, to see Steph Curry doing what he's doing, and Klay Thompson, whose games I had a chance to broadcast at Washington State when I did the Pac-10 and Pac-12 conference, has been fantastic. I never realized Steph Curry was going to be this good. I did three of his games for Fox, two or three of his games when he was at Davidson, and I thought, really, great college player, but I didn't know he was going to be this good. And it is fun to see, and it's fun to watch my friends in the Bay Area, because I lived in the Bay Area for 10 years, go to the games and enjoy this experience as well. Because there's nothing like sports that can rally a city, that can rally a university, like winning, like football or basketball or baseball. I mean, what took place in Kansas City? We had our city expected 300,000 people to show up for the celebration after we won the world championship. We had 800,000 people show up. We only have 2 million people in the 22 surrounding counties around Kansas City, but they came from all over. They came from 8 hours away. They came from Colorado and Oklahoma and Arkansas and Missouri and Iowa and Nebraska to celebrate with this championship team. And one of the cool things about Kansas City, Yogi, we had only 3 arrests, and
wow,
2 of them were for public urination because we didn't have enough porta potties to handle that volume of people. But it's one of the great things I love about Kansas City, and also one of the reasons they call it the Heartland.
Yeah, I want to get to the Royals here in a second. I'll only keep you for a few more minutes, man. But you spent a lot of time in Anaheim working with the Angels. Didn't end incredibly well, right? You know, when you guys part ways, I was always – and I didn't really know you then, but I can remember reading an article in the L.A. Times – and then talking to you afterwards about it. And you're always so gracious for your time there. You put in so much time, and you are a figurehead down here in Orange County in the Los Angeles community because of your time there. A, what was that experience like there? And then when things went south, why did you remain so gracious?
Because that's my job. I mean, quite frankly, I never take it personally. I read a book called The Four Agreements, and I may get a few of them wrong, but one of them is don't take anything personally. Your word must be impeccable. Do your best and don't make assumptions. So I was with the Angels for 14 years and I thought I would finish my career there. I mean, I loved it, but things changed and they wanted to go in a different direction. And they told me I didn't do anything wrong, but they just wanted to go in another direction. So I didn't take that personally. And I also know one of the cool things my agent, Martin Mandel, told me, he said, Steve, it's not going to be difficult to get you a job because you have a very good reputation. The four things I always do, Yogi, I'm always on time, I'm always prepared, I'm always enthusiastic, and I'm a good teammate. I'm easy to work with. And I figure if I can do those four things and I get fired, I can still go home, look in the mirror and say, hey, you did your job. So I can't take it personally. And the other thing is, in those life difficulties, there are always seeds of opportunity. And the seed of opportunity was now I was available for my hometown team. And the Royals called me up and said, hey, if something comes up, would you be interested? And I said, absolutely. Well, something did come up 2 years later. And Now I'm the broadcaster for the Kansas City Royals, and I love it. And it's a great organization. And I'm talking about the Glass family, some of the things they do, the charitable organizations they're involved with. I'm very proud of the giving that they've shown in the community, and also the dynamic leadership from our general manager, Dayton Moore. I really want to work for good people. And these are really, really good people. And then to see success happen, and we have in the last 2 years going to the World Series and winning one, has been fantastic. And that's why throughout life, you're going to have ups and downs. But there's always opportunity. As the old cliche, when one door closes, another one opens. But are you staring at the closed door or the open door? I'm always looking for the open door. But I will say this. It really helps to have a great partner. And the first person I called was my wife, and then I called my agent. And I'm driving home, and you know, I'm feeling a little sad after the Angels let me go. But my wife greets me at the front door, and she goes, "What cool new adventures ahead for us." And that was like a huge weight lifted off my shoulders where, you know, you're thinking as a husband, as a father, you know, you're responsible for other people, not just yourself, and you need to work. But when your wife, your life partner, has such confidence in you and has such joy, and she takes a look at this as an adventure, and we did. I mean, we went on a road trip together. We couldn't have done that during the middle of the summer. A 5-week, 7,000-mile, 17-state, 7-national park road trip. I never would have been able to do that. She also said, "You love whitewater rafting. You've always wanted to go down the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon. Now you can do it because you're going to get a baseball job, and then you won't be able to do that." So I did that. I went down the Grand Canyon and went in the Colorado River for a week. And I have my wife to thank for that. You know, she's a real light. And when you have that partner, much like your mom and dad for each other, boy, it's awesome. And the way I look at Stacy is, this is the person I want to walk home to God with. And she's the best friend I've ever had in my life. But she's done those little things that seem small to her, but were huge to me. And one of the huge moments was, what cool new adventure is ahead for us?
So on this adventure that leads you back home to Kansas, and you're in front of 800,000 fans at this parade after winning the series. You've already been to one there. Did you have a moment where, I mean, you love stories. You're a storyteller. You're an author. We're going to get to that in a minute. But did you have a moment where you're like, wow, this is like an epic story right now about this kid who dreamt of calling the Royals games and listened to them as a child, and now I got a World Series ring. That's pretty sweet.
Yes, it is. And I thought of that. And perhaps it's my age why it meant more. I'm glad I am doing the Royals towards the end of my career. And, you know, obviously I wanted to go on many more years. I'm 61 years old, but I'm loving it. But had I done it at the beginning of my career, I don't think I would have stepped back and enjoyed every single moment of the postseason or every single moment of the regular season when they were getting ready to clinch. And just going down in that dugout and watching these young people come together and care about each other, it's been very cool. But as a kid, my team was the Royals and the Chiefs. I had two teams that I absolutely adored and worshipped. And then later in life, I remember I was working for Sports Time Cable Network when I was in Cincinnati, moonlighting. My main job was at WLWT, but I remember they asked me to do a Kansas City Royals game, and it was during the 85 season. And that was the year that the Royals won the World Championship that year. But there was a game, and my favorite player was George Brett. And during that game, he hit a 3-run home run to tie the game in the 7th inning. And I remember going, when I made that call, going, wow, I was the kid in the stands, and now I'm broadcasting this great moment. Well, then you fast forward another 30 years, and I'm one of the broadcasters for the Royals, and now I'm calling these moments again. And, you know, George Brett is one of our vice presidents and one of the real inspirations on the team. But to watch these young men come together, it is amazing. And there are times where I'm in the booth looking down in the fans, and I'm going, I was that kid. I was that kid back in the 1960s and 70s and at Old Municipal Stadium. I was that kid now at Kauffman Stadium in the 1970s watching this team at first lose to the New York Yankees, the dreaded New York Yankees, and then to find the success. But I really am glad it's this time in my life where I'm able to step back and really watch it happen, not only just describe it on radio or TV.
Speaking of stepping back, what's your advice to young broadcasters or people in this profession that get criticized and have to deal with criticism? Right now, it's so easy to get to somebody, right? We check Twitter literally in-game, post-game. You've been a guy for as positive as you are. You're a strong guy as well. You know, I've been around you in those moments where you're ultra competitive. You know, you're not just, you're the nicest guy that I've ever met, but you're also a ridiculously competitive guy. So what do you say to, you know, younger professionals that are either on their way into this profession or are in it now and have to deal with that?
Actually, Yogi, I'm not very competitive. I am focused. I am driven, but I wouldn't call that competitiveness, because sometimes when you're competing against somebody else. I compete against myself. I've always wanted to do the best that I can do, not better than someone else. And once again, I don't take things personally. And when you're in broadcasting, you're going to be criticized. People are going to say, you're not as good as Vin Scully. Vin Scully is the greatest baseball broadcaster of all time. And if someone says, hey, Steve, you're not as good as Vin Scully, I said, man, that guy included me in the same sentence as Vin Scully. What a compliment. I just do the best I can. And like I said, the four principles I have, I've got to be on time. The bus leaves today at 2:30. I'm going to be on that, and I'll get to the ballpark early, and I'll be prepared. I'll be a good teammate. I'm working with Steve Stewart, my color commentator, and Don Freya, my producer engineer. I want to get together. I want to bring joy back to the listeners, and hopefully that joy is a Kansas City Royals victory. But I think a lot of life is what you make it. And if you're looking for problems, you'll find them on the baseball field. You'll be able to look down and see a mistake. But if you also look at it as, these guys are human and they're doing their best they can to find success. And will it be tonight? I don't know. But I do believe that you have to start with yourself and you have to look for the good. And I do think naturally I am an optimistic person. And when April begins, even if my baseball team came in last place, I think we're going to win the World Series. That's just the way I look at it. And now we did win the World Series, and now we're defending champions of the World Series. But I don't look at myself as a competitor. I'm a little embarrassed to say, growing up and participating in sports, I'm that guy who could have given more. I could have tried harder. I don't think Yogi Roth is that guy. I think you're the guy who left everything on the field. I do enjoy a good story, and maybe that's the way I compete, trying to put together information to tell a good story for our listeners.
Well, it's a great point. I mean, when I go to college campuses with the Pac-12, you know, just like you would do on Fridays, I usually talk to the communication school, and I always make sure we have a conversation about competition, because if you pull it up on your phone right now, you will look at the word compete, and it's to strive against someone, something. But if you look at the Latin root of it, it's to strive together. And to me, because of your four principles, by competing against yourself, that made me, when we were partners, want to raise my game, because I knew that we were competing together. It wasn't about who had a better statement or a better nugget. And so I think, like, even in, you know, without even trying, Steve, like you forced Sam and myself and our entire team when we were young and getting going to compete, to be on time, to be prepared, to be enthusiastic, to be a great teammate. So, I think it's a fun word to talk to, because I hear kids all the time and it's crazy competitive out there, and it's about taking a shot at one another. And I think we've got that word kind of screwed up to a certain degree. And the Royals, I think, are a great example of striving together, whether they're the backup shortstop or the starting middle infielder.
You're exactly right. And I think the quickest way to lose track of your team goal or your spiritual center is to compare yourself with someone else. As soon as you do that, you lose focus of what's important for the team. It's to win. So how do you do that? You pull together. And if you're an offensive guard, you have certain responsibilities to find success as a unit, as the 11 players. And for a broadcast team, it's much the same way. if one person is not getting along, and I'm saying, let's say the producer has an ego that is making life difficult for his talent, and then they're thinking about that rather than, but if you've got if the color commentator wants the play-by-play broadcaster to sound good, and the play-by-play broadcaster wants the color commentator to sound good, and he wants, and those two want the producer and the directors to look good, and the audio guy and the video guy, and he treats each of them with grace and kindness. How do you fail? It's really difficult to fail, and it doesn't matter what environment you're in. But I've always thought, as soon as you compare yourself with someone else, and in professional sports, it's, if I hear someone say, well, my stats were this, and this guy's were this, and he gets paid more, I go, oh, man, now you got a problem. But if you can leave your ego in the locker room, much like the Royals do, I think they do a great job of leaving their ego in the locker room, coming out and playing together. And how do you fail? And you brought up something about a young broadcaster, what I would tell them. Don't be afraid of failure. You're going to fail. You're going to apply for a job and not get it. You're going to get fired in our profession. And those are not always disappointments, but you can make them disappointments if you focus on them. So once again, focus on the open door and just trying to get better. And for me, I knew that I wasn't that good to start with. I couldn't start at the network. I had to start in Hastings, Nebraska, put in my 2 years' time there, and then in Topeka, Kansas, 4 years there, and then 4 years in Cincinnati. And then I went out to San Francisco, and that's where I really got my break when I did Major League Baseball and the NBA, and then did ESPN for 7 years, and then was with Fox after that. But don't let anyone tell you something that keeps you from doing what you love. And in my case, I love play-by-play, and I've had people come up to me and say, you stink at play-by-play. Okay, well, that's your opinion. I'll move on. You know, I've been fired before, and but someone else hired me, and I've now been working 41 years doing one job, which is play-by-play. It hasn't always been in the same city or for the same organization, but I've always been employed, and I just continue to do those four principles, and I continue to get work.
So I got to rewind the clock a little. Go back to 2009, because there's a memory that is etched in my brain, and I'm just curious what your recollection of this is. We're in Pullman, Washington, crazy snow. It's you, me, Sam Steele, who's now Sam Ponder. It's our first season broadcasting together, our first season really ever professionally broadcasting. And you're a guy who had done Major League Baseball, NBA, major college basketball, major college football, obviously the MLB. What do you remember about that afternoon? I'd love to get your perspective on it, because I'm sure Sam and I's point of view of our experience, it may be totally different than yours, because when we look back on that game, both of us probably shudder in how bad we were at our craft. At least I can speak for myself. I know that. I'm sure Sam was great.
You know what I noticed immediately? Passion and enthusiasm from both of you. I had never met you, and I think we had communicated like on a text message or something like that. We knew we were going to work together and maybe made a phone call. Well, I get to the hotel, and the first thing I wanted to do was I wanted to work out. So I go to the gym and I'm working out. And then you, and I told you that's where I was going to be. And then you come in and you jump on the treadmill and you're running so fast. I'm going, oh my gosh, this guy's got some kind of energy and enthusiasm. And then the three of us got together for dinner that night. And the thing I noticed the most from Samantha, from Yogi, was passion and enthusiasm. You were so excited to be there, to be part of this event, and to be part of this business. And that's contagious to me. I want to be around people like that. I want to be around people that are inspired, that are fire, that are happy. And both of you were, and I'm going, this is going to be a blast. And the three of us worked together, I forget how many years together, but every single moment was fun. We had a blast, even when we'd have interesting discussions that we didn't always agree on. Sometimes there were spiritual discussions, sometimes there were football discussions, but we loved each other, and we were inspired by each other's thought or ideas, and we were open-minded enough to have these interesting discussions. So I always remember the passion and the enthusiasm from that first day in Spokane, Washington, and of course driving over together and doing the game in Pullman. So it was those two ingredients that fired me up to do the game with you.
That's so funny. I remember looking at my board and going through the pronunciations with you and me not having the pronunciations on my board. And for those that don't know, broadcasters have these boards with the depth chart on them. And you gave me like the parental scolding of like, Yogi, you need the pronunciations on your board. And I felt like one inch tall.
Oh, but from this day on, I didn't want to make you feel that way, but that's why if someone says, I'll give you an example. If someone said, how do you spell Mark Teixeira? I couldn't do it. I write it down phonetically each time. Mark Sepchinski, the left-handed pitcher. I can't spell his name, but I can tell you how I write it down phonetically.
Man, you taught me everything, man. Sam and I, we owe a lot to you and Roy Hamilton was teaching us the basics. But I want to finish off on two things before I let you go, man. And they kind of go hand in hand. You are a really adventurous traveler, you know, and this podcast is called Life Without Limits, taking risks, going places that, you know, not only in our lives, professionally, personally, but also for fun. You always take these really cool trips. Curious what's next, and also want to dive into your book. I mean, I've known you for, my 8th year of broadcasting coming up. So we've been buddies for 8 years, and I've heard about this book for probably 6 of them. And I'd love to know what the latest is on both of those fronts.
Well, my developmental editor says, Nicole Ayer says it's time to get it out now because she just thinks the parallels with what is taking place politically in the United States parallels this. And my book is called The Walls of Lucca. And I'm a wannabe writer, but I take a look at it like this is my golf. I have a job, but I love to write. And so I'm a bad golfer. I'm trying to get my handicap from 100 strokes down to 95 and from 95 down to 90. And Nicole Ayers, who's my developmental editor, has been helping me. But The Walls of Lucca is about a spiritual woman named Isabel Roselli who helps break down the barriers that separate two families in Lucca, Italy, trying to grow and produce a great Sangiovese wine in Italy's most difficult times. World War I, the rise of fascism, Mussolini, and World War II. And these two families, one are the wine owners who have money, the other are the winemakers who don't have as much money but live on the same property. And it's the walls that they build around themselves to protect themselves from problems that don't even exist, but just the assumptions that they exist. But they just want to grow a good grape and produce a good wine. And during this time, World War I happens, and then the rise of fascism. And I don't want to compare it to what is taking place, but there are parallels with the failed war and what can take place politically and what can arise from that. And quite frankly, there's some challenges in our political adventure. And I'll get back to the team sport philosophy rather than give away the book. But if players care about others more than themselves, they come together and they can win. And if a husband cares more about his wife than himself and a wife cares more about the husband than herself, you're going to win. Then the same thing I think is true politically. If politicians or parties truly put citizens first, how do you fail? And so there's a link with that. So right now what I've done is there's two books. One takes place from 1914 to 1930. The other picks up in 1938 to 1945. It's a romance. It's a love story. It's a story of forgiveness. But my lead character is this woman named Isabel, who is a spiritual, a dynamic individual. And my the way I created her, as you might imagine, she's my wife. You know, that's That's why I created Isabel. She's a person, regardless of the tragedies that befall her in her life, she looks for the good, and she finds it. And she is vigilant to choose peace every single time. So that's where I am. And now my developmental editor said, it's time to get this to an agent. It's time to get this in front of the public. So I'll be doing that in the very near future.
That's awesome. Well, make sure you let us know, and we'll be promoting the daylights out of it. And before I play a little game at the end, but Steve, I got to know, what's your next trip? I know the season just started, but where are you guys heading after the baseball season?
Well, we have all of these bucket list items, and Stacy and I have Patagonia, where you have been before. We'd like to go hike Machu Picchu. A lot of times what we do is try and find things that are either south of the equator, because we have to travel during the winter months. We'll probably go to Hawaii and to California, but on our bucket list is New Zealand, hiking New Zealand and Australia. But you're an adventure seeker, and I always live vicariously sometimes through you and where you are going, because it's life is an adventure, and you're amazing. I mean, just some of the places you've been, the people that you've seen, and the friendships that you've made along the way are really incredible. And I think everybody you touch and meet leaves you and goes, man, what a cool guy. I think I'd like to be more like him. And that's true.
Well, all right. So the last thing, Steve, here we go. Before I let you go, I'm going to hit you with a series of words, maybe 8 words. After each word, just give me your quick, instant reaction. Okay? Here we go.
All right.
Word number 1. Husband.
Husband, love. I mean, that's my job. My job is to love my wife, and I've done that to the best of my ability in my 31 years with Stacy, but she sure does make it easy. I've said many times that raising children to me was work. Being married to Stacy is the easiest thing I've ever done. So being a husband is all about love.
Okay, you might have just answered this one, but father.
Father is, oh my gosh, that goes so deep, because at the beginning you are a protector, and then later in life you are a teacher, and when they grow up and they become independent, all of a sudden you become just a demonstration. And I told Stacy, I said, words mean nothing anymore with Ryan and Kevin, but the demonstration that we have in expressing our love to each other, my wife to me, me to my wife, that's all we can do. And they see how we live. So, you know, in the beginning, it's a protector. In the middle, it's a teacher. And now it's just a continued demonstration for my children.
How about grandfather?
That's the coolest thing. I have 3 granddaughters now. And we have a 5-year-old Taylor, a 3-year-old Elliot, and then a recently born Grayson. But Taylor is just an incredible light. And I say that because she's been through challenges in her life. She was born with a cleft lip and cleft palate, and we've been through the surgeries with her. So this young lady has such compassion and such understanding. Even at the age of 5, you look in her eyes and you go, boy, there's a depth there that's incredible. And we love all 3, but there's something about the first that just kind of completely captures you. But I just can't wait to be with them, and that's what we're going to do over the All-Star break. We have a little family reunion up in Michigan, and I can't wait to see them. But, boy, what a joy they are, because no longer do you have to be a protector or teacher. Yes, you do. But more so, you're a play toy. You're their adventure land. And the best advice my daughter gave me, she said, it wasn't advice. She just goes, Dad, now remember, it's my job to discipline them, not yours. And I go, great. I didn't want to do that. I just want to have fun with them.
Steve, what makes you feel most alive?
My faith, I would have to say. And I used to think it was a little silly when I heard people say you have to put God first. And to me, God is only love. He is not a God of wrath. He's not. I don't believe in sin. I don't believe in the devil. I think you know where my heart is. But I believe only in a God of love. And if I can keep my focus on love, it's amazing how everything falls into place. The love of your wife, the love of your children, the love of your grandchildren, the love of your teammates, the love of your coworkers. And so to me, it's my faith.
That's great. All right, last couple. We'll get you out of here. Politics.
I beg pardon?
Politics.
Politics? Oh, well, if you look at the meaning of the word, poly meaning many and tick meaning blood-sucking vermin, I say that in a comedic way. But I'm just disappointed a little bit in both sides that they can't come together. We're not Democrats and we're not Republicans. We are Americans. And that's what bothers me the most. That's why when politicians make the decision to put their citizens first, they're going to have success. And that's why we're on the same team. It's kind of like the Kansas City Royals. We have players from the Dominican Republic. We have players from Venezuela. We have players from Florida. We have players from Texas. We have players from California. But they don't care. They don't separate themselves. They come together, and these fingers become a fist, and they become a force. And that's the way I think we've got to look at politics. We have to do it for the citizens. We have to do what's in the best interest of our people, not our party. And I think when we do that, we will come together not only as a people, but as a humanity nationally. And I'm not just talking about our country. I'm talking about the world. When we put others first rather than attack, and I think we'll find peace. And one of the great lessons that you told me was now we're going to go on forever, because it was when you went to Palestine alone. Yeah. And that was a very compelling story, and perhaps you're going to tell that story on one of these podcasts later, but you are a person that reaches out to others, even reaches out to others who might be perceived enemies, and you bring them into your mix, and you show them kindness, and hopefully they're going to go, you know what, that guy wasn't that much different than me, that Yogi Roth is, we share the same principles. And then all of a sudden, I mean, to me that's a miracle. A miracle isn't some fantastic mega event like a parting of the Red Sea. To me, is when a past hatred becomes a present day love. That's a miracle.
Yeah, that's pretty rad, man. Okay, last two. Vulnerability.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Vulnerability.
Vulnerability. Oh. I think we all have to be vulnerable so we understand the challenges of others. Sometimes we hold on to our beliefs so tightly that we don't understand what another culture, another person is going through. But if we're vulnerable, if we're open to understanding, then we can, and we'll be able to listen with an open heart and find our commonalities rather than what separates us.
And lastly, limits.
Limits. Well, I know an individual who has no limits, and that would be you. And I don't like to have any limits as well. I like to challenge myself, and that's why I'm trying to write. I'm not a writer, but I'm trying to write. And I think I've become better as the years have moved on. I remember when I took a look at my first manuscript and I reread it to edit, and I'm going, oh my gosh, this is horrible. A sophomore in English couldn't have done a worse job with this, but I'm working on it. I'm trying to get better. But those are the limits we put on ourselves when we say, I can't do this, or I'm not good enough. Well, sometimes that leads you to another area. But I think challenging yourself is the greatest thing, and that's why I love to challenge myself. I don't want to put limits on myself. Do I have some doubts and some fears about my ability as a writer? Sure, but I'm moving past it, and I'm ready to get that query letter out there and get a hold of some agents and see what they think of my book. Even if they say, this is awful, Steve, this is terrible. Well, then I'll go to the next agent and see what he thinks and see if we can make this happen, because I do think it's an interesting story to tell. It's a wonderful story of forgiveness, but I'm challenging myself. I'm not putting a limit on myself or because of the perceptions of others.
Wow. Well, Steve, this was awesome, man. I mean, so many nuggets. I'm taking notes throughout the entire conversation. I have pages of notes, and not surprised, man. And honestly, every question here, I didn't know the answer to, and to get to learn about your story, and you're so open, so gracious for that, was really an absolute blast, man. So I appreciate the time, and keep kicking butt. Gotta go get another ring now for the Royals, man.
Absolutely. That would be fantastic. And I hope you have time to break bread with Kevin and I when we're out in the Bay Area to do the A's. And I know you're up there to do a little Pac-12 action.
Yeah, for sure. We'll make it happen, bro. I appreciate it. You know, I got nothing but love for you, and give the family a big hug.
I will do that. I'll give Stacy a call right now, as a matter of fact.
Awesome. Thanks, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Have a great day.
You got it.
Bye.
Yeah. So there it is, man. Steve Cizziak. How awesome is that? What a great guy. I mean, I said it early on. I've known him for over 8 years now. And there's one thing to have a partner when you're calling games and you're on the road and you get to know him pretty well. But there's another to really connect with somebody. And it makes the broadcast better. I think fans can tell it. And as a young guy in this profession, I know, and I can speak for Sam as well, when we got going in this, to have him as a mentor was awesome. And he's a guy that I continue to call and there for me. And I think for us, as we put an end to this podcast, there's so many little nuggets that I took away. One is, we work in the toy department of life. I'm going to totally steal that. Two is that he continues to be a seeker as a guy who's been in this profession for 40 plus years. Three, one of my favorites that I'm totally going to use is every night and every morning he gets his compass back to north. And how present is that? You want to talk about the Four Agreements, an incredible book, and we'll put that link in the blog post. And then finally, his love for his wife. He mentioned Stacy, who knows how many times, but that's him. That's ever since the moment I met him, he talked about her. So I want to say thanks to Steve. It was awesome. And for all of you, as always, I try to leave the podcast with a challenge. And I think we should look to Steve as our inspiration here. He's been broadcasting major sports for 40 plus years. And he finished this podcast interview talking about how he needs to keep challenging himself and get out of his comfort zone. And he's writing a book, and he doesn't give it the love he deserves. I've read elements of it. It's going to be a great book, but I think that's really important, as well as when adversity comes in your life, to see the positive. For him to share that story about him and his wife, I think for all of us, we should challenge ourselves to say, how am I looking at adversity? How am I challenging myself? How am I looking at things that maybe don't go my way in life, because the sun does come up and we get another opportunity, just like he and his wife did, just like he did, and hopefully just like all of us are. So thank you once again. If you can, leave a review for us on iTunes, share it with your friends. This thing has gone bigger and faster than I anticipated. It has been absolutely radical to go through this process, and I owe it to all of you guys. So thanks for listening, and as always, remember that the only limits that we set in life are the ones that we set ourselves. Lots of love, and we'll talk to you soon on the Life Without Limits podcast. Peace.